Hi, I'm Jesse Hirsch. Welcome to the Future Herd. What does it take to lead an industry through disruption when you come to it as an outsider? Not so much an outsider in the literal sense in that you're coming home, but an outsider in terms of bringing a fresh perspective. My guest today, Donald Killorn, the Executive Director of the PEI Federation of Agriculture, is a fascinating case study in what happens when you bring a career built on coral reefs, Costa Rican rainforests, and Bay of Fundy whale conservations to one of Canada's most agriculturally intense and productive provinces. PEI grows a quarter of all the potatoes in Canada. It punches way above its weight in dairy, beef, seafood, and carries an ecological commitment that is world-leading. And Donald comes to this farming through ecology. And that lens shapes everything about how he sees leadership, systems, and the future. He's someone who thinks about determinism, entropy, and the exponential growth curve of human civilization, and then turns around and figures out how to help potato farmers survive a federal export. The question that runs underneath this entire conversation is a good one. Can the skills you build on the edges of an industry be exactly what the industry needs at its center? I think that applies not just to the conversation we're having today, but all of the challenges that the sector faces. As a consequence, I think you're going to really dig this. And warning, we do nerd out a little bit on AI. But again, I think in a manner that is relevant and applicable, not just to agri-food, but to society as a whole. All right, let's tune in. Donald, welcome to the Future Herd.
Thank you, Jesse. Great to be here. Congratulations to you on launching a new podcast. It's going great so far.
Right on. Thank you. And there is much to discuss. You conveniently bring an intersection of topics that I am very much eager to get into. But I like to start every episode with the same kind of question, meant to be a kind of gut response. What does the future mean to you?
Yeah. What does the future mean to me? Oh, man. Yeah, some kind of future state. Where have we come from and where are we going? I don't know, Jesse, like in my private moments, I think that we can see the future as easy as we can remember the past. So, you know, Einstein would argue that it's all big one loaf of bread, you know, and we're just cutting slices out of it. So I think one of the cool things about, I know you're very interested in artificial intelligence, and it does seem to be sort of the change. There's a lot of talk about determinism and how determinism is being utilized by these technology companies, and it does seem like we're in a more probabilistic moment. But you know, the future for me, I hope is abundant. I don't know, man, it's a great question. Entropy is an idea that they teach you in undergraduate biology class and expect you just to kind of understand it. It's a very simple equation, but it's once you get older, it's quite terrifying. So the future is exciting and terrifying and can't be avoided. So, you know, let's dive into it.
Right on. Fantastic answer. And to your point, I love when I'm hanging out in AI spaces, I love to use that Einstein quote of why can't we remember the future? And it really gets their heads wrapping around the theory of relativity as it applies to the singularity. I'm digressing, bringing us back to agriculture before we will talk about AI. I kind of like to, my second question, sort of circulate around the idea of where someone came from or where their expertise came from. And in kind of classic PEI fashion, you seem to bridge both the farming side and the fishery side, although maybe aquaculture may be a relevant phrase you could choose to use. But how did you end up where you are now? And I say this on the one hand because most of the folks I've met from Atlantic Canada are travelers, are people who get around, but at the same time are also the kind of people who want to come home and make sure that they kind of spend their lives living in the community that they really identify with.
Yeah, I mean, I live and work in on the Sherwood Road in Prince Edward Island, which is just at the edge of Charlottetown. And I grew up in a neighborhood of Charlottetown called Sherwood. I mean, I'm literally working. I can see the university. I can see my high school. You know, I pass my childhood home on the way to work every day. But that's a relatively new phenomenon. So I've been in agriculture now for 4 or 5 years. But before that, I spent about 20 years exploring the Caribbean and other parts of Atlantic Canada. And along the way, I developed, I always was passionate about ecology. From the moment I encountered it in third year university, I knew it was the thing that was most interesting to me. And I worked in exceptional ecosystems in the Costa Rican rainforest and on the barrier reefs of the Turks and Caicos Islands and Belize, and slowly morphed from an ecotourism guide at 22 into a small business operator, and finally into someone doing academic research around natural resource management. And found myself on the Bay of Fundy. You know, I was interested in coming back to Canada. I was 30 years old. I'd never paid any taxes, which was really nice in retrospect. But I really had to start establishing myself as a Canadian. And then I worked on the Bay of Fundy for about 10 years, did some really cool stuff there around underwater noise, helping to ensure, like, literally trying to save the whales. And was already interested in technology, did a really cool, like, augmented reality viewer around climate change and amongst other projects. And then at 40, I really felt like I needed to come home. I bounced around a little bit more, spent a little bit of time in Florida in, like, the most Republican congressional district in the country, and came home to run the PEI Federation of Agriculture. Agriculture, it's similar to Manitoba or Saskatchewan in Canada in terms of the amount of the economy it makes up, the number of people it employs. It's 40% of the land. And important for me, it's 25% of the emissions profile. And so agriculture nationally is 10%. Here it's 25%. I come to agriculture as a sustainability professional. There's a great interest in sustainability in agriculture, and I have found a really wonderful niche in Canadian agriculture as someone who doesn't know as much about the NPK side of it, but brings you know, academic approach to sustainability and uses that to try and affect change in a complex system.
I'd love to unpack that a bit, especially in terms of the nature of the agricultural industry and PEI, especially to your point, it playing a larger role within the province. But let's take a moment to talk about ecology, because clearly that influences your kind of understanding and perspective on sustainability. But ecology is not necessarily a limited concept. I mean, part of what always blows my mind about ecology is the way it can be applied to so many areas and domains of expertise. So I'd love for you to riff off that. And if I have to frame it as a question, you know, how has your ecology of leadership kind of evolved as you've clearly been spending your professional life, your personal interests, playing with and exploring this concept?
Yeah, fully. Yeah, man. I mean, there's an ecosystem underneath my fingernails, you know? So, and there's applied ecology is such an interesting way to look at the human experience. And it's scary. And when you asked about the future and what the future looks like, I'm living through the end of the exponential growth phase of humans, or at least Homo sapiens. And I think a lot about what comes next, and it informs my thinking about the future greatly. You know, I have ideas about how, according to ecology, we will have to go from 8 billion Homo sapiens to, you know, a much smaller number, and we'll have to do that very quickly. And so I don't think that necessarily has to be catastrophic, but it's certainly, like, it's certainly some type of techno accelerationist future state where the Homo sapien is an outdated firmware. So yeah, ecology, I think of everything that I'm doing is applied ecology, and I'm quite interested in, I've grown quite interested in sociology. I've started reading philosophy books in 2017, and so guys like Michel Foucault, who are looking at human behavior, sociology, and sort of giving us, freeing us from the responsibility of some of these things, and sort of placing humans as like as the entity that's being acted upon by sociology. Like we're a vessel for evolution, and sociology is a form of that, and it's just applied ecology. Now, in terms of leadership, you know, man, I'm the kind of guy who at 4 years old, I was making the plan, you know, like I come by being the leader, I don't know any other way, you know, and I'm not really capable of doing anything else. Like, Lord knows I've tried to join the public sector or like big corporations along the way. Like, I've definitely lost faith at times, and they don't want anything to do with me. Like, they can smell me coming from a mile away, right? So I have one place in this world, and it's as the leader of a small team that is, you know, empowered to pursue projects of interest and hopefully of some, you know, common good that considers the future. I mean, my stated goal, like, I have to beat the government and the private sector to the spot. And when they get there with the money, like, I have to already be standing there, you know, established. And that's the only way to survive as an NGO executive director for 15 years is to keep beating the government to the spot. And when they announce the funding envelope, you're kind of there and sort of waiting for them.
Right on. And that's such, again, a brilliant way to think about ecology, because on the one hand, it affords a sort of systems analysis, a very rich, deep systems analysis that, to your point, lends itself the opportunity to be where people are going to be, to identify where the opportunities or pressure points are. So let's translate that to both how you described yourself and the kind of agricultural ecology or ecosystem on PEI. Because on the one hand, you've got the advantage of being an islander, right? You were born there, you grew up there, you could kind of not only swim in the culture, but be able to, you know, assert that sense of belonging. Yet you also described yourself as an outsider, that you are bringing, I think, an external expertise. You've, in your travels, in your professional journeys, you've acquired a number of really relevant skills that you might not have been able to acquire if you had exclusively worked within the agricultural sector. So how do you balance that perspective in terms of engaging the sector, or more to your point, mobilizing the sector so that you can be where, you know, the politicians, where the market, where the money is going to end up, so that you can be the beneficiary of that kind of foresight?
Yeah, I mean, it really starts with integrity. You know, it starts with integrity. It starts with people being able to take you at your word. Everything flows from that, you know, and that's something that everyone, if they don't know, they should learn. And if, you know, if they're early in their career, it's the best advice you can get is to look a person straight in the eye and do, you know, say what you're gonna do and do what you're gonna say. So, you know, locally it's still more challenging than nationally. You know, nationally, those skills of sustainability and stakeholder engagement, like my master's degree, it technically is in environmental practice, but really effectively it's in systems thinking and how to develop multi-stakeholder partnerships. And it lends itself very well to NGO leadership for sure, because I'm always looking to build tents, you know, big tents around and have partners be tent poles. And the Federation, there are things we do that sort of fall outside of the systems thinking sustainability framework that I've established, you know, long-term stuff, advanced payments program, environmental farm planning, things we're here that need to be done and that, you know, farmers need us to do. But around climate change and sustainability and the reason why we're working in artificial intelligence is there's a resilience framework that I built here, that designed, and it involves all the four types of stakeholders, the academic, the industrial, and the other NGOs, and then government. And it involves the capital buckets that drive my thinking, my work, you know, governance capital being the sort of superstructure, and then ecological, economic, and social capital, understanding those different buckets, you know, that verbiage, that kind of thinking has been very effective at the national level, making partnerships, developing relationships in a short amount of time, and finding some success with the Canadian Federation and having them support us as an organization that understands farmer governance and how it can be utilized in a very data intensive world. Locally, on Prince Edward Island, to be perfectly honest, I'm blessed to come from good people. My grandparents were wonderful people, both sides, and my family, my parents and my aunts and uncles are good people, and it's not unusual for someone to know someone that shares a last name with me or went to school with you know, someone that you know, my mother's maiden name, someone on that side of the family. Like, I benefited greatly early on from the patriarchal sort of 80-year-old still owns all the shares in the farm. Maybe his son doesn't really know what to make of a watershed manager coming to run the Federation, but he gets a little nudge in the gut and saying, this guy's, you know, he's going to be okay. We're going to give him a chance, you know? And it's cool. It's a very PEI thing, you know, but I've come from good people and I benefit from that and I'm grateful for it.
Right on. And I do want to come back to a phrase you used that I'd love to learn more about, governance capital. But before we get there, let's unpack the PEI side a bit more, because I suspect that there are listeners who, you know, maybe know PEI vis-a-vis potatoes, but do not understand the breadth, let alone the expertise that I think resides within the agricultural sector there. So help us break it down at a kind of, you know, meta level, if you would.
Sure. Yeah, totally. So potatoes are a big deal. I don't even know if potato farmers appreciate how many potatoes are grown on Prince Edward Island. 25% of all the potatoes grown in Canada are grown on Prince Edward Island. That's an unbelievable number, considering there's 170,000 of us in a country of 40 million. And the land mass is, we're blessed with iron-rich soil, this classic like red cliffs of Prince Edward Island. And that feeds the potato. 60% of our potatoes are processed into potato chips or largely like French fries and other, and hash browns, other stuff. And then 30% go to the fresh market, and 10% are used as seed. And we famously have the best seed potatoes in the world. And equally as famously, we're not allowed to ship them off Prince Edward Island right now. So we are under a long, now multiple year order. Actually, the order, I don't know how familiar you are with this, but CFIA stepped in and the American government has pressured them to limit the export of potatoes from Prince Edward Island. There was a total ban on potato export that came into effect 5 days after I started my job. I mean, I'm talking about, like, I have no agriculture experience, and now like $1 billion industry is been closed down. And so my job became just to sort of talk smack about CFIA in the paper. Like, that was really the only thing I was qualified to do, was like point out sort of shortcomings of the governance. But anyway, so potatoes are a huge part
tangent to the tangent. Can you explain what happened there? Like, what was the, I mean, again, the way I'm reading it is,
it's a really, they're it's trying a sensitive to take, topic.
We love sensitive topics here, but I trust you'll navigate today. It diplomatically.
Yeah, it's a sensitive topic. There are, somehow or another, like, we do have a small amount of potato wart in our soil. It's known. They're in known places. And at that, the Canadian government came under pressure in November of 2021 to close the border to Prince Edward Island potatoes. And so rather than risk an export ban to that was put in place by the United States, the Canadian government took what we were told was a proactive step to limit the export, to basically halt the export of potatoes and other crops that came from the ground, which was like we couldn't sell turnips or onions or carrots or anything. Nothing with soil on it could leave Prince Edward Island, which was a very heavy-handed response from the federal government. They drew a box around one of their boxes around the whole province and said, this area of Canada is infested with potato wart. And I mean, I'm talking, we have 6 fields maybe in Prince Edward Island of all of our thousands of agricultural fields that have known. And that's after what came next, which was a multi-year extreme sampling event that returned no additional positives. And so we watched all this and our farmers were hampered. And even today, our seed potatoes still can't leave the island. But so, you know, potatoes are a big deal and we deal with pests every now and again, and they're very disruptive to our farming and our economy. And we also had the worst drought of our lifetime last growing season. And we are working on that as well. We are working in a number of different ways to try and prepare our farmers for the reality of climate change and variability. The stability of the climate will be something we look back upon with, you know, great fondness in not just already, but in 20 years in particular. And that's an exponential change, and that's always important. But back to our industry, like potatoes aside, it's just as big as you can imagine. It's integral to our economy, and never a dull moment for sure. But the dairy, our dairy industry is so cool. So in the 80s, there was an amalgamation of all these little community dairies into Amalgamated Dairies Limited. And it's a cooperative really owned by the dairy farmers, and they buy 99% of the milk coming out of Prince Edward Island. So as soon as we leave the province, we see really good dairies, you know, AgriPure, you know, really solid. Those trucks are on the road in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick. That's who owns the dairies in those provinces now. And we're blessed with this totally holistic milk system where the milk is being bought by a dairy owned by the dairy farmers, and it's producing just the best of the best, you know, this the best of the best, man. The best cheese, the best ice cream. Like, it's just unbelievable. I mean, Prince Edward Island is an unbelievable place. We have a federally inspected beef plant, so there's 20 of those. We have one of them. And so, I mean, I'm eating, like, baked potatoes and steaks and lobster tails and mussels and oysters and just the best ice cream. Like, I can't stress how good the ice cream is, you know? And so I'm half Scottish. My cousin tells me, like, I need ice cream to live. Like, my people have been eating ice cream, like, for, the, you know, seaweed as long. Like, my understanding is that as someone with Scottish ancestry, I need ice cream to live. And so this is a really good spot for me.
Right on. And you've also kind of,
I could go on, man. Like, the Honeycrisp apples are incredible. Like, we're just getting our first crops of peaches. Like, we're not commercially viable with peaches, but, like, our first load of apples went to Florida last year. Like, we grow a Honeycrisp that's just, I mean, is Honeycrisp well known? It must be. I don't know. Do you know what a Honeycrisp apple is?
It's starting to. And again,
it's wild, man. It's wild.
We're a little entrepreneur in the sense that, you know, we're within the industry, so I think we get a sense of how these things are developing. And you've raised a couple of interesting points,
man.
There.
I mean, I've got 20 pounds of fresh frozen blueberries, strawberries. Like, the food is so good here. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Well, and really, and crazy. Let's dig into that.
And it runs, the economy runs on it.
You know, on the one hand, you're clearly demonstrating the value that an ecology perspective brings to agricultural leadership. Because, you know, to your point, we will wax nostalgic about these stable days of climate in the months and years to come.
Yeah.
But you're also evoking another element of the future of agriculture, which is processing, which is value add, which is everything from agritourism, yeah, to the best food in the world. So give me a sense of that ecosystem as it exists on PEI, and even further, kind of your role in collaborating with the larger food ecosystem. I'm assuming you do that as someone who eats, but I'm also assuming you do that as someone who is a leader within the sector as a whole.
Yeah, our board added, sustainable food, like sustainable food and food system. Food system was added to our mission in our most recent strategic plan update this year, which I think is important. It's a blessing, you know. So we have the dairy. We have a huge amount of our potatoes are being processed right here on Prince Edward Island, we're speaking just a few hours ago. The passing of Robert Irving was announced, who owns Cavendish Farms and has employed all those people and built all that infrastructure and invested all that capital in processing those potatoes. And so condolences to his family, as many of which are close to the Federation, and acknowledge him as a real agricultural force. And then, you know, Wyman's is here, so we're processing our own blueberries, and the beef plant. It's been interesting to watch, particularly in the dairy and the beef plant. They sort of went through tough days, and both benefited from great leadership. And it's not a guarantee that you just build one of these facilities and it works. It takes smart people, particularly in to go out and find the markets. Like the CEO of the beef plant is on the ground in Japan and on the ground in Korea, trying to unlock those markets for the plant. So there's a huge role there in business to make those plants successful. I think, and then I see that in the greater Canadian conversation, which I'm sure you're familiar with, but just for your listeners, like there's a huge drive on in agriculture to increase value add. We are not building plants and processing facilities at the speed of our competitors and neighbors. And we're falling behind in economic activity and agriculture as a result. And it's a perfect example of red tape standing in the way of international capital of capital investment, which is a huge mark of the Carney government to sort of reverse that and deal with the red tape that stops capital from flowing into Canadian businesses, and agriculture's chief amongst them. We're growing so many like legumes that are then being shipped out of the country to be processed and then brought back and paid for by Canadian consumers. Like it's really shocking. And at CFA this year, we had a really good farmer from out west, which is the whole country from here. But anyway, so from out west, who held up like a box of chickpea pasta, which I love, and like stuff like that. Like we have to think a bit more broadly about how to, the same way that we want to build the cars that we buy in Canada, we want to create the food that we eat from sort of farm to table. We want to create as much of it inside Canada as possible. And on Prince Edward Island, we're blessed with great processing, and that empowers our growers and generates. We know that 50% of it. 50% of agricultural's economic impact in Prince Edward Island is from processing. And so we're a third of the economy, but that's agriculture and agri-food. And so if you take away the processing piece, you have the production, and so much of the production is there to support a market that's local with the processors that would further reduce. And so it's a massive part of having a food ecosystem that functions at the local scale and also at the national scale.
Right on. And I definitely want to talk to you about access to capital, specific within PEI. But your point about, you know, being on the ground in Japan and South Korea kind of allows me to confirm or get you to deny the perception around PEI as a brand internationally. And my hunch would be that it would be a premium brand, that there'd be a lot of people around the world who would associate PEI with the high end of food, as you yourself are doing. Am I right in that? Like, what are the efforts around either reinforcing that brand or expanding it further?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, I might get in trouble for this, but in my travels, in my personal travels, which are pretty extensive, everybody knows about the mussels and the oysters. Like, there's nowhere else in the world to get mussels and oysters like this. You're not going to do as well sort of with the potatoes. Like, the idea that we're a potato powerhouse doesn't translate necessarily outside of Canada. Our dairy, again, is there. People are eating ADL products without even knowing they're ADL, so we really do well with white label stuff. So the dairy is maybe news to them as well. I don't know where we're at with beef. I haven't really been around, but, you know, Alberta Beef is I would say, a brand. Now, that's not to say that I think that that's a superior product. And, you know, I'd put our blue dot up against theirs any day of the week. But the efforts are major. We have NGOs in PEI that are specifically tasked with this, with growing this food island. It's obviously a huge part of our 21st century tourism effort. Food is a huge part of the tourism economy here. And rightfully so. I mean, I've been to Italy a couple of times the last few years for work, and I get back and I'm like, man, you know, they have flavors and approaches that are cool, you know, but in terms of just quality ingredients, I mean, I get back here to to my little farm to table lunch spot, and it's just blows the doors off it. You know, it's the caliber is so high now. So we put the effort in, and I don't know how well we're doing, but when people get here and they eat the food, I know it blows their mind. Like, it's out of this world, Jesse. Like, you sit down to dinner, you get a surf and turf here, you know, it's like we have this joke around the dinner table, like, what are the rich people eating tonight, you know? Like, Mother's Day, like, I have this 12 pounds of lobster on the table, you know, like, and you know, ribeyes, like, you know, and baked potatoes from East Point Potato, which is, you know, it's, and then ADL ice cream for dinner. I mean, what, you know, it's, I could talk about it all day. We've been at this for 30 minutes. We haven't got past the ice cream, man. Like, it really is that good. And the government does invest in it, and they do want it to be a part of our profile. How well they're doing with that, I don't know. You know, but I do know that in my travels, we certainly have the best mussels and oysters in the world. And that tends to be the thing that at least Americans are most familiar with.
Well, and if my questions become less articulate, it is because my mouth is watering. And I can attest to my own couple visits to Charlottetown that the food is undeniable.
I never get tired of talking about it. It's crazy to have the best beef and the best shellfish in the same place that also grows 25% of the potatoes in Canada and all these other great vegetables. It's wild, man. It's really paradise, you know, and we almost, you know, we're really blessed. It's, well, you know, 6 months of the year, it's the nicest place in the world.
And to your point, we could spend our entire conversation strategizing around how to emphasize to more people, not only PEI as a destination, but to your point, as a source for the greatest ingredients, the greatest food. I do, before we get into the technology stuff, which obviously is a huge and favorite topic of mine, I do want to spend a moment kind of talking about some of the issues that really transcend regions and areas across the country. And the biggest is demographics and succession issues, which, you know, are a challenge in various communities. But I suspect, and this is just a hunch, that they might be different or at least more nuanced on PEI. This is kind of the opportunity to get into the access to capital piece, because that is part of it for younger farmers who want to take over, who want to get into it. But it also gets into the issue of, you know, an aging sector, an aging population. I'm curious what some of the challenges are, again, from an ecosystem approach, and how you guys are trying to tackle that.
Yeah. Regulation is an interesting thing, you know, because it's a pressure, you know. And so the reality on the ground evolves around that pressure, you know, and evolution is all about response to pressures. And so we limit corporate land holdings at 3,000 acres, and individual land holdings are limited by provincial law at 1,000 acres. And so that plays a big part in defining our industry. Our land has traditionally been very affordable and remains very affordable compared to other places in Canada. Now, like other places, we've seen a significant increase in the value of the land. So new entrants has become a strongly supported local issue by the provincial government. And I've always looked at provincial governments as an opportunity to address larger trends in a local setting. Like, I expect the provincial government to do everything they can to protect us from the impacts of larger trends around economics and environmental pressure. I expect the provincial government to do everything they can to counter that. So they are extremely focused on facilitating access to the next generation of farmers on Prince Edward Island. We just see everything that's being seen across Canada. The average age of our farmer is approximately 60. The amount of money it takes to purchase a farm has gone up dramatically. And so you're left with this economic puzzle that you have to put together. How do you empower a well-educated, well-trained young farmer who's ready to take on the risk of borrowing $6 million and hoping that the crop comes in, you know? And how do we de-risk that in a way that's economically responsible? And it's a challenge. I mean, the government can't just purchase a bunch of farms and make them available to young people. I mean, we get that a lot. Why can't we just, like, have a land bank, you know? And there's all sorts of reasons why we can't. And there were things done in the 80s when farmland was hardly worth anything, you know? And there were things done then that can't be done today because it's so valuable. So, yeah, how do we facilitate access to the next generation? How do we secure fair exit for the current generation? How do we achieve our climate goals, our sustainability goals, and how do we engage with our Indigenous neighbors and bring reconciliation to agriculture in a meaningful way? How do we do all those things in a place like Prince Edward Island, where the population is growing, our land use planning is extremely poor, like worst in the country poor, and it's chaos. It's a chaotic growth of population that's costing us long-term wealth. And no matter how hard we push on the government, we can't seem to get them to take land use planning seriously. And because we're not effectively drawing boxes and creating those regulatory pressures for long-term wealth generation, we are losing agricultural land at a significant rate, and that's not helping the cause for the next generation. It's simply making agricultural land more scarce. And so you don't need a degree in economics to know what happens when you diminish the supply. It's very nuanced. This is a fine segue into technology. I believe that Web3, made up of AI and blockchain, will facilitate more cooperative purchases of farms. And you know, it's easy. It's possible to go out and raise capital and with your partners and buy a farm and farm it. But it's going to get easier to understand what that land is likely able to produce, raise that capital from, you know, headless sources looking for guaranteed yields, and get into where the deed is an NFT and its performance is tracked on chain, and I think that's likely part of the solution, but can't be counted on by policymakers today as the whole answer.
Well, And this is where I do have to express sincere gratitude in that I'm learning a ton about the agricultural scene on PEI. And to your point, the kind of unique regulatory environment and the challenges and opportunities it offers. But we have, over the course of our conversation today, been promoing that we are going to spend time talking about technology. And you have been weaving an interesting through line of sustainability, you know, which is, I think, an inherent byproduct of an ecology approach. So please elaborate on kind of how you see the opportunity that leverages technology, that leverages data. And I think the other thread that we've been talking about is the unique agricultural environment that Prince Edward Island has, both from a skills perspective, an industry perspective, but you alluded also from a soil perspective and a climate perspective. Let's connect all those dots. Tell me a little bit about your initiative and the opportunity that technology has to really take agriculture to the next level.
Yeah, Prince Edward Island is an amazing sandbox. And I saw it when I was young. We adopted really intense waste management, like curbside recycling and sorting. And, you know, we brought a huge landfill diversion, 90% landfill diversion, completely changed the way we managed waste when I was a teenager. And that was really profound to see us adopt change as a community that you just couldn't do in other provinces because of our size. And so that I've always known that PEI is a great testbed. And with our really strong industries, you know, like we have really legitimate industries here, and it makes for a great testbed. I mean, people in technology talk about a moat, like the Northumberland Strait is a phenomenal moat, you know. And I say to our local stakeholders, like, we have an opportunity to build something here that the world really needs, and that's a fully vertical approach to agricultural capital intelligence. And so agriculture is perhaps the least intelligent capital in our economy. You know, it's $1 trillion worth of capital in Canada. If you think of the difference between a farmer buying insurance or financing a crop and the amount of information available versus if you're buying real estate or if you're buying a security, and those buckets of capital are hugely intelligent. And information technology has come to agriculture in different ways. I mean, obviously farmers are huge adopters of technology. I mean, you know, the plow is we've started from nothing, and agriculture is the backbone of our civilization, and we continue to become more technologically adept. But in data management, in the data piece, since, you know, 2000, when data has started to be collected and stored to some degree, like agriculture has kind of, you know, there's been a lag in our ability to collect, manage, and analyze data. And I think that we're approaching a critical moment where those three skills finally converge, and we unlock the capital, the intelligence of the capital, and the land. Farmers become a bit more land managers, and we sort of know exactly what that is expected, and we put these, like, the agronomy piece of agricultural intelligence is the core, but you put these wings on it where, you know, you attach the financing and the insurance and the marketplace, and all of a sudden you have this massive capital construction, and the land is simply the investment vehicle, and that's really exciting. But I guess, you know, so that's I don't even know where to begin. So we're building an agricultural intelligence platform called Ag Intel. It is every bit of an artificial intelligence implementation. It is AI first, AI native. It is built for the agent economy. It expects to interface directly with headless agents. on behalf of farmers. It is built like a fortress for farmers' data. It is designed to be governed by farmers, for farmers. It is built by farmers. I'll tell you the story of it. Maybe that'll help maybe articulate it better. I live inside of it. It's a bit tough to step outside of it. But I knew that the governance of data was very important. I heard it from farmers at the Canadian Federation meetings, and I was thinking about carbon credits as soon as, from the moment I arrived. I mean, I came here to generate carbon credits, and we were asked to administer the On-Farm Climate Action Fund, or awarded it, or allowed to administer it. So I immediately started awarding funds to eligible projects for change of practice. So we were creating voluntary carbon credits, you know, when we started administering OFCAF 3 years ago. And so I was working on that really naively, thinking it was going to be easy. And then we realized that we needed a huge investment of data management infrastructure to be able to unlock the voluntary carbon market or the regulated carbon market. We've been sitting around waiting for Environment and Climate Change Canada to write the soil carbon protocol for the National Greenhouse Gas Registry, that's a whole other story with Alberta and the MOU and the Carney government turning the cost down to zero. But so we realized we needed all of this data, and then we realized, Jesse, that if we collected all that data, we would have all the data we needed to implement precision agriculture. And so now we're really getting somewhere, and it gives me tingles just thinking about it. And so so then what? So now we knew that we had to collect a shit ton of data from the farmers, right? And so what does that mean? How are we going to do that? And we encountered this problem. Okay, farmers are very nervous about who's going to own their data. And I became an advocate for farm organizations like the PEI Federation of Agriculture as the trusted layer, the trust layer in the data ecosystem. I pointed out that these organizations like ours already have farmer-led governance. They're already electing their leadership from their members, and all we have to do is just add data to the thing that they're considering, and alongside policy and advocacy and programming. And these organizations exist all over the world. Wherever there's farmers, there are farm organizations, and these organizations are perfectly suited to solve this implementation question. And that idea alone, before Claude Code, before any of this stuff, that idea alone was enough to take me around to Washington and Ottawa and over to Rome. And like, it's an idea that's very infectious. I've had great success communicating it. It makes perfect sense to people. I've encountered other people from Mexico or Europe who are thinking the same way. It's not particularly novel, but it was enough in Canada to sort of position us as the leaders on the topic. And so we were advocating for funding. We applied for funding from our governments to simply transmit data from an IoT device, an Internet of Things device, so a sensor in the field, to a Federation-owned server. We wanted to prove that we could make carbon credits using edge computing. And we applied for that funding, and we waited and we waited, and we went through all the hoops you have to go through to get federal funding. And in October, we received a few years of support from Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada to do this one thing, to beam data from the field into a Federation-owned server. And we quickly got matching funding from the province. So that's December. And then in January, Claude Code arrived. And software engineers, professional software engineers, like the one I work with, who's a farmer and a software engineer, all of a sudden became superhuman. And one software engineer could now do the work of 10 software engineers. And agentic AI emerged. And a few other tools. I don't know if you know about autonomous research loops, but Alex Carpacci, who was at OpenAI, he developed the autonomous research loop. We have bolted together a few of these things into what we call MOD, which is our agronomic AI system. And we're waiting on $100,000 worth of edge computing parts from Hong Kong. And when they get here on Friday, we're going to go out into the field and we're going to light this thing up.
Now, we earlier on the episode broke news about the death of one of the Irving family members, to your point, very key in the PEI processing sector. We can also break news that Andre Karpathy, the person you just mentioned, has just been hired by Anthropic. That is how revolutionary his research loop has become.
What a great get.
Yeah, two bits of news here on the podcast. I'm overwhelmed with questions.
I sent the research loops. I sent the research loops to Matt, who's our software engineer and just a stone cold genius, someone who's been waiting to build this thing his whole life, been working on his sixth generation farm his whole life, struggling with these problems. And I sent him the research loop, and he lived with it for a little while. And the next time I saw it, he had stripped the code out, loaded it into the platform, and it was now refining our carbon models and our nitrogen models. And we went from needing a license for denitrification, decertification model, to having our own 10-step pathway. Basically, Mod built her own model. Mod has connected the dots on how to model soil carbon. She's created a couple of different metrics around soil mass and around plant available water. Through the research loops, and so we have, I think, we now have a research loop that runs. We have a series of research loops that run around simply what the model needs. So Maud runs research loops on what she can actually use. She only turns them on when she needs them. And precision agriculture now, if people aren't asking the question about what data needs to be moved where and when, like, that's really what precision agriculture will be, is the precision movement of data to the right model at the right time. And that's the big thing. And we've developed the Canadian Agriculture Compute Strategy in response to that. Once you engineer intelligence, you know, I have level two questions now, level two commentary, that you see people who are thinking about AI and agriculture, and until you're actually building it and you have synthetic model data and it's informing your thoughts, you know, there are questions that you don't even think to ask.
And we are kind of running out of time. And here is where I will preview that we are going to have you
back.
We
spent so much time talking about ice cream, which I'm going to look
understandably,
back on and say, man, maybe not. Maybe shouldn't have spent so much time about the ice cream.
Well, no, and we are going to have an AI panel, which I'll have you back on. But I want to connect something you just said, which I think is quite profound. And where I think you and I have a tendency to kind of really nerd out and get into the advanced high tech, I want you to bring it back to kind of the grassroots and especially the farmer grassroots. And this is the first time I've even had the chance to ask a guest this question. What impact do you think vibe coding could have on agriculture and on the farmer who understands systems but is just now exploring software development?
Yeah, I think that even right now, as we develop the front end of AgIntel, I think that we are spending time dealing with a UX, like a user experience paradigm that doesn't really exist anymore. We are in the last moments of bespoke, like app-specific UX. And so Matt and I were talking this weekend, it gives me chills just thinking about it again. Like, are we building the right thing? Are we thinking about how to empower the farmer? We have thought so much about how to create the data warehouse that can empower this one chatbot approach to intelligence and information. Like, we haven't even considered, we only just started considering that we're actually building that interface as well. But we think very open source about what we're building. We want to work with other builders. We want our, you know, data structure, including the governance, to be available and known as the farmer first governance approach. And we want other people, whether they're flying drones or, you know, doing soil carbon analysis or like whatever it may be, like we don't want to be thought of as a competitor to that. We want to be thought of as a collaborator and as an asset that can be brought into that project to help uptake, or, you know, help. We hear so much, Jesse, about technology that gets developed and the bottleneck is in adoption. And AgIntel is designed to help with adoption. And while our agronomic semantics are, I think, world class, and you know, in a vibe coding age, I think intellectual property begins at your ability to take these remarkably disparate types of data and analyze them as elegantly as possible. And so if someone develops better agronomic semantics, then fine. Like, let's have them served by Mod and ensure that that Canadian farmers are getting the best.
And, you know, again, we have to have you back, because I think your ecology approach really allows you to operate in the ag tech space in a way that I think very few others are able. And you just articulated, I think, quite brilliantly there. So I am torn in that, on the one hand, you have made me hungry, because we spent so much time today talking about food, that I do have to start wrapping this up, even though I could spend another hour getting into agriculture in the agentic era, which we will get to in the future. But I have to ask the question that I often ask guests, but in this case, directly related to what we were just describing: what are the policies that make the systems you were just describing, that make the shared infrastructure you were just describing, flourish? Because you have acknowledged today the good and negative aspects of policy and regulation in terms of enabling innovation. So this is the part of the show where we get to be a little brainstorming, a little blue sky in terms of the policies we would love to see.
Yeah, I really work these days to position agriculture within the larger AI strategy. I think agriculture deserves to be positioned as a strategic sector and dealt with directly by Evan Solomon's work around agricultural compute. I've met with Quebec stakeholders and Manitoba stakeholders in the last few weeks and asked them both for electricity, which is a funny thing to ask. My message has gone from farmers need to own the data to farmers need to own the compute to farmers need to own the electricity. You know, we need farmers in Canada, whether they believe it or not, they need a gigawatt hour. You know, they need a gigawatt a year. They need to be able to move about 15 teraflops around, and we need about $150 million, you know, to roll out edge computing in a serious way, and it will pay off, and the world will want this technology, and our farmers will become more competitive, more productive, and it'll be the best $150 million we ever spent. So. We have a draft strategic compute for agriculture, and it shows the difference. You know, I mean, if we tried to move every bit of agricultural data around into the main models, you know, that's 200 gigawatts. And so we need intelligent computing where we don't need to be sending every piece of data off the farm. We need to be strategically sending, you know, we call it the novel gating approach. We need to be strategically moving data off the farm. And so, you know, privacy and those policies are important, but ultimately we need the next policy framework to include a serious investment in data infrastructure on the farm. And we don't need 5G everywhere. You can use AgIntel over radio and then send it to the server when you have the opportunity. So don't necessarily believe in the cell rollout, but for this purpose, but we need to invest in research and development. We need to invest in edge computing infrastructure. I think we missed it in the second part of OFCAF. I think we missed it in the last national policy framework, which was ostensibly about sustainability, but to have sustainable agriculture, you need an intelligence layer on top of the field. And that's going to take some dollars.
What a powerful sentence right there. If you want to get sustainable agriculture, you need data intelligence from the field. Again, my brain is exploding at the way in which you are connecting the dots and the way in which you are weaving together a very powerful vision of the future of agriculture. The last question that I always end each episode with is similar to the first, in that it's really meant to be a kind of gut response. We're not looking for a long, thought-out answer. It's really the first immediate answer that comes to mind, and it's the shout-outs. Who are the leaders that you look up to, that inspire you, that you think the rest of us should be following, should be tuning into?
Yeah, I always, there's an economist in at the University of Central London, Maria Mazzucato, who's about to come out with a new book, who really helped me understand how to make change in complex systems through mission-driven portfolios of projects. Thomas Piketty is a French economist, Capital in the 21st Century, I always recommend to students. Jean Baudrillard is a French philosopher, so The Perfect Crime or Simulation and Simulacra. Jay-Z has been very helpful at times. I actually quoted Jay-Z earlier in the podcast. I'm not sure if you caught that. Look a man dead in the eye and talk truth to him. So, you know, again, you know, more and more I'm inspired by my grandparents, even though they're not with us anymore. But I think that's probably a pretty good list.
And to your point, I think Jean Baudrillard helps us understand the opportunity of digital twin technology and the role of world models in helping to better understand.
And shout out Marshall McLuhan. I mean, I gave a Marshall McLuhan quote at the Senate last a couple weeks ago. Like, you know, you see the Heritage Minute when you're young, you don't really get it, but he's every bit the thinker that Jean Baudrillard was, and there's not a lot of people who saw the radio or the light bulb or whatever it was and could envision what was going to happen. And Marshall McLuhan was one of them. And certainly he's an all-time thinker. Chief Hugh Akagee is, I want to give a shout out to Chief Hugh Akagee, who taught me so much about sustainability and how to work with our indigenous neighbors and, just, it never stops, Jesse. It never stops. Never stop learning. Never stop dreaming. Ambition's a dangerous drug, man, but what a trip it is. You know, it's really, really a great time, and I'm grateful to the farmers of Prince Edward Island for letting me have this role, and grateful to you for the time today.
And to your point, life is short, so you might as well keep on learning and living. And you have been, I think, the first person who's allowed me to note that when we started thinking about this podcast, I had just picked up a new puppy who is a collie mix, and that was part of the concept of the Future Herd. And that puppy's name is Marshall McLuhan. So it does seem very fitting and appropriate that we've ended as we've had. Now, after I press stop on this recording, I am going to be sending an email to two of our prior guests, Mohsen and Mohammed, and yourself, inviting all three of you onto a future AI panel episode, because there's been just too much for us to get into in this limited format. And I think that you have a vision for AI and agriculture in this country, which really balances the need for responsibility with the need for accelerated innovation. So thank you, Donald. This has been an absolutely fantastic episode.
Keep it up, Jesse. It's great. It's a great podcast. I'm looking forward to being back with those two gentlemen and looking forward to that conversation. And I'll see you again then.
I suspect it comes with no surprise that I could have kept talking with Donald for a couple of hours, and not just about the technology stuff. I love learning about, in this case, agriculture and PEI, but agriculture right across the country, because the more you understand it, the more you see the nuances, the specific regional, cultural, geographic specifics. And that's where Donald's ecology, his systems thinking, his centering the human through all of this is really refreshing. And I, again, enjoyed the way in which he kind of connects the dots between the community-centric vibe of PEI, the exceptional food, and the vibrant agri-food industry. If you want to dig deeper into anything we've covered today, we do have a website, thefutureherd.ca, where we generate knowledge articles to go with each of our episodes. We also have a semi-regular digest that covers news happening within the sector. And of course, there's our comments platform, where we encourage people to share their views. In no small part, because what I really enjoyed about today's conversation is the way that it not just helps people within the sector, but really everybody, everyone who eats, see the big picture as to where our food comes from. Because that is a system that we can't neglect. And I think the more people who participate in that system, the more people who bring their skills and expertise to that system, the more resilient, the more capable, the more prosperous, the more accessible that it can be. All right, until next time, we'll see you soon.